Chapter 19. In the name of reason and common sense, the captain burst forth, what do you want to assemble the people for? Don't you realize that my ship is burning beneath me? McCoy was as placid as a summer sea, and the other's anger produced not the slightest ripple upon it. Yes, captain, he cooed in his dove-like voice. I do realize that your ship is burning. That is why I am going with you to Mangareva. But I must get permission to go with you. It is our custom. It is an important matter when the governor leaves the island. The people's interests are at stake, and so they have the right to vote their permission or refusal. But they will give it, I know that. Are you sure? Quite sure. Then if you know they will give it, why bother with getting it? Think of the delay a whole night. It is our custom, was the imperturbable reply. Also, I am the governor, and I must make arrangements for the conduct of the island during my absence. But it is only a 24-hour run to Mangareva, the captain objected. Suppose it took you 6 times that long to return to Windward. That would bring you back by the end of a week. McCoy smiled his large, benevolent smile. Very few vessels come to Pitcairn, and when they do, they are usually from San Francisco, or from around the Horn. I shall be fortunate if I get back in 6 months. I may be away a year, and I may have to go to San Francisco in order to find a vessel that will bring me back. My father once left Pitcairn, to be gone 3 months, and 2 years passed before he could get back. Then too, you are short of food. If you have to take to the boats, and the weather comes up bad, you may be days in reaching land. I can bring off 2 canoe loads of food in the morning. Dried bananas will be best. As the breeze freshens, you beat up against it. The nearer you are, the bigger loads I can bring off. Goodbye. He held out his hand. The captain shook it, and was reluctant to let go. He seemed to cling to it as a drowning sailor clings to a life buoy. How do I know you will come back in the morning? He asked. Yes, that's it, cried the mate. How do we know, but what he's skinning out to save his own hide? McCoy did not speak. He looked at them sweetly and benignantly, and it seemed to them that they received a message from his tremendous certitude of soul. The captain released his hand, and, with a last sweeping glance that embraced the crew in its benediction, McCoy went over the rail and descended into his canoe. The wind freshened, and the Pyrenees, despite the foulness of her bottom, one half a dozen miles away from the westerly current. At daylight, with Pitcairn 3 miles to Windward, Captain Davenport made out 2 canoes coming off to him. Again McCoy clambered up the side, and dropped over the rail to the hot deck. He was followed by many packages of dried bananas, each package wrapped in dry leaves. Now, Captain, he said, swing the yards and drive for dear life. You see, I am no navigator, he explained a few minutes later, as he stood by the captain aft, the latter with gaze wandering from aloft, to overside as he estimated the Pyrenees' speed. Why, you must fetch her to Mangareva. When you have picked up the land, then I will pilot her in. What do you think she is making? 11, Captain Davenport answered, with a final glance at the water rushing past. 11. Let me see, if she keeps up that gait, we'll sight Mangareva between 8 and 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. I'll have her on the beach by 10, or by 11 at latest. And then your troubles will be all over. It almost seemed to the captain that the blissful moment had already arrived, such was the persuasive convincingness of McCoy. Captain Davenport had been under the fearful strain of navigating his burning ship for over 2 weeks, and he was beginning to feel that he had had enough. A heavier flaw of wind struck the back of his neck and whistled by his ears. He measured the weight of it, and looked quickly overside. The wind is making all the time, he announced. The old girl's doing nearer 12 than 11 right now. If this keeps up, we'll be shortening down tonight. All day the Pyrenees, carrying her load of living fire, tore across the foaming sea. By nightfall, royals and top gallant sails were in, and she flew on into the darkness, with great crested seas roaring after her. The auspicious wind had had its effect, and fore and aft a visible brightening was apparent. And the second dog watched some careless soul started a song, and by eight bells the whole crew was singing. Captain Davenport had his blankets brought up, and spread on top the house. "I've forgotten what sleep is," he explained to McCoy. "I'm all in. But give me a call at any time you think necessary." At 3 in the morning he was aroused by a gentle tugging at his arm. He sat up quickly, bracing himself against the skylight, stupid yet from his heavy sleep. The wind was thrumming its war song in the rigging, and a wild sea was buffeting the Pyrenees. Amidships she was wallowing first one rail under, and then the other, flooding the waist more often than not. McCoy was shouting something he could not hear. He reached out, clutched the other by the shoulder, and drew him close, so that his own ear was close to the other's lips. "It's 3 o'clock, came McCoy's voice, still retaining its stove-like quality, but curiously muffled, as if from a long way off. We've run 250. Crescent Island is only 30 miles away, somewhere there dead ahead. There's no lights on it. If we keep running, we'll pile up, and lose ourselves as well as the ship. What do you think, heave to?" "Yes, heave to till daylight. It will only put us back 4 hours." So the Pyrenees, with her cargo of fire, was hove to, biting the teeth of the gale, and fighting and smashing the pounding seas. She was a shell, filled with a conflagration, and on the outside of the shell, clinging precariously, the little motes of men, by pull and haul, helped her in the battle. "It is most unusual, this gale," McCoy told the captain, in the lee of the cabin. "Be by rights there should be no gale at this time of the year. But everything about the weather has been unusual. There has been a stoppage of the trades, and now it's howling right out of the trade quarter." He waved his hand into the darkness, as if his vision could dimly penetrate for hundreds of miles. "It is off to the westward. There is something big making off there somewhere, a hurricane or something. We're lucky to be so far to the eastward. But this is only a little blow," he added. "It can't last. I can tell you that much." By daylight the gale had eased down to normal. But daylight revealed a new danger. It had come on thick. The sea was covered by a fog, or, rather, by a pearly mist, that was fog-like in density, insofar as it obstructed vision, but that was no more than a film on the sea, for the sun shot it through, and filled it with a glowing radiance. The deck of the Pyrenees was making more smoke than on the preceding day, and the cheerfulness of officers and crew had vanished. In the lee of the galley the cabin boy could be heard whimpering. It was his first voyage, and the fear of death was at his heart. The captain wandered about like a lost soul, nervously chewing his mustache, scowling, unable to make up his mind what to do. "What do you think?" he asked, pausing by the side of McCoy, who was making a breakfast off fried bananas and a mug of water. McCoy finished the last banana, drained the mug, and looked slowly around. In his eyes was a smile of tenderness as he said, "Well, Captain, we might as well drive as burn. Your decks are not going to hold out forever. They are hotter this morning. You haven't a pair of shoes I can wear? It is getting uncomfortable for my bare feet." The Pyrenees shipped two heavy seas as she was swung off, and put once more before it, and the first mate expressed a desire to have all that water down in the hold, if only it could be introduced without taking off the hatches. McCoy ducked his head into the binnacle, and watched the course set. "I'd hold her up some more, Captain," he said. "She's been making drift when hove to." "I've set it to a point higher already," was the answer. "Isn't that enough?" "I'd make it 2 points, Captain. This bit of a blow kicked that westerly current ahead faster than you imagine." Captain Davenport calm promised on a point and a half, and then went aloft, accompanied by McCoy and the first mate, to keep a lookout for land. sail had been made, so that the Pyrenees was doing 10 knots. The following sea was dying down rapidly. There was no break in the pearly fog, and by 10 o'clock Captain Davenport was growing nervous. All hands were at their stations, ready, at the first warning of land ahead, to spring like fiends to the task of bringing the Pyrenees upon the wind. That land ahead, a surf-washed outer reef, would be perilously close when it revealed itself in such a fog. Another hour passed. The three watchers aloft stared intently into the pearly radiance. W, what if we miss Mangareva? Captain Davenport asked abruptly. McCoy, without shifting his gaze, answered softly. Why, let her drive, Captain. That is all we can do. All the Pomatas are before us. We can drive for 1,000 miles through reefs and atolls. We are bound to fetch up somewhere. Then drive it is. Captain Davenport evidenced his intention of descending to the deck. W, we've missed Mangareva. God knows where the next land is. I wish I'd held her up that other half point, he confessed a moment later. This cursed current plays the devil with a navigator. The old navigators called the Pomatas the Dangerous Archipelago, McCoy said, when they had regained the poop. This very current was partly responsible for that name. I was talking with a sailor chap in Sydney, once, said Mr. Connig. He'd been trading in the Pomatas. He told me insurance was 18%. Is that right? McCoy smiled and nodded. Except that they don't insure, he explained. The owners write off 20% of the cost of their schooners each year. My God! Captain Davenport groaned. That makes the life of a schooner only 5 years. He shook his head sadly, murmuring, bad waters! Bad waters! Again they went into the cabin to consult the big general chart, but the poisonous vapors drove them coughing and gasping on deck. Here is Mironaut Island. Captain Davenport pointed it out on the chart, which he had spread on the house. It can't be more than 100 miles to leeward. 110. McCoy shook his head doubtfully. It might be done, but it is very difficult. I might beach her, and then again I might put her on the reef. A bad place, a very bad place. We'll take the chance, was Captain Davenport's decision, as he set about working out the course. Sail was shortened early in the afternoon, to avoid running past in the night, and in the second dog watch the crew manifested its regained cheerfulness. Land was so very near, and their troubles would be over in the morning. But morning broke clear, with a blazing tropic sun. The southeast trade had swung around to the eastward, and was driving the Pyrenees through the water at an 8-knot clip. Captain Davenport worked up his dead reckoning, allowing generously for drift, and announced Mironaut Island to be not more than 10 miles off. The Pyrenees sailed the 10 miles, she sailed 10 miles more, and the lookouts at the three mastheads saw naught but the naked, sun-washed sea. But the land is there, I tell you, Captain Davenport shouted to them from the poop. McCoy smiled soothingly, but the captain glared about him like a madman, fetched his sextant, and took a chronometer sight. I knew I was right, he almost shouted, when he had worked up the observation. 21, 55, south, 136, 2, west. There you are. We're 8 miles to windward yet. What did you make it out, Mr. Connig? The first mate glanced at his own figures, and said in a low voice, 21, 55 all right, but my longitude's 136, 48. That puts us considerably to leeward, but Captain Davenport ignored his figures with so contemptuous a silence as to make Mr. Connig grit his teeth and curse savagely under his breath. Keep her off, the captain ordered the man at the wheel. Three points steady there, as she goes. Then he returned to his figures, and worked them over. The sweat poured from his face. He chewed his mustache, his lips, and his pencil, staring at the figures as a man might at a ghost. Suddenly, with a fierce, muscular outburst, he crumpled the scribbled paper in his fist and crushed it underfoot. Mr. Connick grinned vindictively and turned away, while Captain Davenport leaned against the cabin and for half an hour spoke no word, contenting himself with gazing to leeward with an expression of musing hopelessness on his face. Mr. McCoy, he broke silence abruptly. The chart indicates a group of islands, but not how many, off there to the northard, or nor-westward, about 40 miles the Actian Islands. What about them? There are four, all low, McCoy answered. First to the southeast, is Machueruai, no people, no entrance to the lagoon. Then comes Tenarunga. There used to be about a dozen people there, but they may be all gone now. Anyway, there is no entrance for a ship, only a boat entrance, with a fathom of water. The Haga and Tuarero are the other two. No entrances, no people, very low. There is no bed for the Pyrenees in that group. She would be a total wreck. Listen to that. Captain Davenport was frantic. No people. No entrances. What in the devil are islands good for? Well, then, he barked suddenly, like an excited terrier, the chart gives a whole mess of islands off to the northwest. What about them? What one has an entrance, where I can lay my ship? McCoy calmly considered. He did not refer to the chart. All these islands, reefs, shoals, lagoons, entrances, and distances were marked on the chart of his memory. He knew them as the city dweller knows his buildings, streets, and alleys. Papakana and Vanavana are off there to the westward, or west-northwestward 100 miles and a bit more, he said. Oh, one is uninhabited, and I heard that the people on the other had gone off to Cadmus Island. Anyway, neither lagoon has an entrance. Ahunui is another 100 miles on to the northwest. No entrance, no people. Well, 40 miles beyond them are two islands? Captain Davenport queried, raising his head from the chart. McCoy shook his head. Peros and Manihingai, no entrances, no people. Nengo Nengo is 40 miles beyond them, in turn, and it has no people and no entrance. But there is how? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.